Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Alex Van Horn on the show. Alex is the president of the Central Valley Brewers Guild and the co-owner of Summer Fox Brewing, one of my favorite breweries in Fresno. I was so excited to record this podcast with Alex. Summer Fox is incredible, pushing out some of the best beer in town. And I was excited to talk with him about the beer scene, his thoughts on craft beer and the expanding market, and so much more. This was so much fun, and I know you'll love Alex. And if you really want to nerd out on beer, this is the episode for you. Let's go meet Alex, and Baker will take us there.
Blessed to infiltrate the pod waves on infinite quests, investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best! Fresno's best!
Alex, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
Where do I like to eat in Fresno? I'm not from Fresno, so I've moved here 4 years ago, so my knowledge on good food is limited. But when we go out, there's a little place down the street here called Manchester Philly Cheesesteak.
Oh, is it good?
It's really good. My folks come to town, we always go over there and get their kebab plates. And he's like, best rice pilaf I've ever had. And it's just, he's in like a gas station. No, it's seriously, his name, so it's Armani.
Philly cheesesteaks, kebabs, what else?
And they got burgers and Euros. Yeah. It's he apparently used to own a really like fancy like restaurant with his dad, and then they closed that, and so he's just soloing this 7 days a week. You should do a podcast with him. He's incredible, just as a person and his story that I've heard from him.
Wow. So is the Philly cheesesteak good as well?
I liked it. It wasn't like the best Philly cheesesteak I've ever had. I feel like it's just maybe like the thing that gets him. His burgers are really solid. His like Mediterranean food's awesome.
Yeah.
So he's an interesting guy.
Yeah. Maybe he should consider renaming the place.
Possibly, yeah.
Based on his best product.
All his food's good. And I like going there. There's a pho place that me and my wife like to go, 777 pho over
I have
on.
Been. That's great.
Yeah. What is it? Willow and Knees. Which is right next to where House of Pendragon used to be, the brewery. Yeah. And so that's how we discovered it. We were at Hop, and then we're like, oh, let's go get some pho. And it was perfect because you walk in and you're like, this is exactly what I expect of a pho place. It's like a married old couple, and they're probably first generation here, and they're running a pho place, and it's authentic, I think. And it's great. It's perfect.
Speaking of House of Pendragon, I'm so sad they're gone from downtown Fresno. I don't know if you were here when they were down there.
No, but I did hear about that story. Yeah.
Yeah, it was incredible because they had, I'm forgetting the name of the restaurant. It's in Visalia. It's a Mediterranean restaurant. So you'd go there, get a House of Pendragon beer, and get some shawarma fries. Mm-hmm. And that was one of my favorite things to do downtown. And it's sadly gone. I want to jump into a bunch of topics today.
Yep.
Before we jump into specifics, I want to talk about Jimmy Carter for a second. People don't know that we have Jimmy Carter to thank for our craft beer industry.
Absolutely.
This peanut farmer president. So could you talk a little bit about why Jimmy Carter explains why we're here?
Wow. Okay. Yeah. No, I think it was 79 when he signed legislation that removed prohibitions on homebrewing. And the reason that is important is because myself and so many of my colleagues all started homebrewing. And if there wasn't easy access to it and legality on it, may never have happened, and these people like myself wouldn't have been inspired to move on and start a commercial brewery.
What would the world look like without that legislation? What would happen?
I think you would just see, and it might be actually where we're headed, probably get to that later, but consolidation. I think Sierra Nevada is still happening.
Yeah.
I think there are still people illegally homebrewing who would have done it, but I don't think we would have seen as, I don't think we would have exploded to 10,000 breweries like we have. Yeah. I think it would have been a little bit more at pace. I think the people would have seen, maybe the 90s would have been a little different too with the brewpub movement in the 90s, where maybe it would have been a little bit more thoughtful on, I like beer, but I'll do food. I'm a food person. And those ones succeeded more, I think. And then the ones who were just like, I love beer, I'm a comb brewer. And then they didn't make very good beer. And then the food wasn't, and they failed. So yeah, definitely. I think we'd see, it would have been less velocity on this just incredible growth in the last 15, 20 years, because there wouldn't have been as many interested people. Because it wouldn't have been a hobby that is readily accessible.
Cool. Let's jump into that since we're talking about homebrewing. I've got a couple questions about that subject to start. What's the most common mistake homebrewers make?
Oh, probably dealing with their yeast.
Okay.
Yeah, so one of the it's a fermented product, so really the most important part of the process is making sure your fermentation is good.
Yeah.
And a lot of people really focus on the process of the first 6 hours of making beer, where really it's the 2 weeks after that make or break whether or not that beer is going to be drinkable and very tasty. It's hard to screw it up. It definitely can, but it's hard to screw it up on the brew day. But you definitely, most people screw it up on the yeast side, so not adding enough yeast, not using the correct type of yeast, that type of stuff.
Okay. How long do you think it takes a home brewer to make a batch that could be poured at a tap room? Like, how long in terms of time spent brewing do you think it takes the average person?
Oh, that's fascinating.
Obviously, there's a variety of skill levels.
There's always an exception, right? I would say it takes a couple years. I went from homebrewing to owning my own brewery in about 3 years. Yep. That may be a little fast. Most of the people I know who've opened breweries, they've been doing it for maybe close to a decade. And really, for me, maybe it's less time and more how many batches do you have under your belt? So in those 3 years, me and my friends, we brewed together. We were probably brewing every 2 weeks for the first year and a half, and then I'm like, I want to open a brewery, and I was brewing every week. I was giving a lot of beer away just because I was honing my craft in a sense.
Yeah, and you need more people to try it, right? Because a lot of people think their own shit's so good.
Yeah,
you know?
And especially people with good palates and who are able to give you constructive criticism. So that was nice. I had a little friend group, and we all got into craft beer together in our early 20s, and then we started homebrewing together, and we'd studied BJCP, which is Beer Judges Certificate Program, and we were members of a homebrew club. So like we did a lot of things that impacted how we were able to talk to each other when we had a problem with a beer. It wasn't just, oh, I like it. Do you? Or are you just saying that?
Whereas, and why?
And why? And so we got so curious about the whole process and got into it that we got to a point where we could give each other constructive criticism because it was always about making it better. And that fostered an environment where we learned more quickly.
Okay. What area of homebrew equipment do you think we need more innovation in? In other words, what area of homebrew equipment is it like pretty stagnant and you'd like to see there be more kinds and types of innovation?
There's been so much over the last couple of years, it's pretty crazy. I started in a plastic bucket, and now you can get a stainless conical tank for your house, which is the high end on a fermentation side. Brew houses are all pretty I think we've hit peak.
Yeah,
but okay. You say that, and then you see all these Wi-Fi connected sensors that check pH and gravity and that type of stuff.
So for like the yeast phase that we're talking about, there needs to be more like AI.
Not necessarily readily available. It's not really financially sense for a lot of people. But I don't know how it ever would be because stainless steel is not cheap and it's not going to get cheaper. Whereas there are certain things you can do if you make 10,000 of them, it's almost the same cost as making 1,000 of them in a certain situation. Stainless steel is really not that way. It is what it is.
So there's this concept in big cities called mercados, which is basically like this large center where you have an industrial kitchen and you've got all these kind of stations where pop-up restaurants can operate until they hit to scale and then they can get their own brick and mortar. Mm-hmm. Do you think we need something like that for home brewers where you can have a little brewery pop-up, you can share brewing equipment, and then once you get to scale, because that is a risk once you open up your own shop. What do you think about that?
I think those can be great. I've seen a number of them. Yeah. There's a couple of examples. There was actually one here in town for a little while. It was down in the brewery district that one of our brewery partners here at Summer Fox was part of. So Gravy Brewing was down there. Artisan, what was it? 411 Artisan Ales was part of that. And then Incinerate. And then it unfortunately burned down, so we don't know how that would have played out if it had not. And in San Diego, it's a group of industrial property and commercial property owners, and they've actually built 2-spec breweries, about almost a dozen of them now. There's a couple in Carlsbad, a couple in Mira Mesa, a couple in 3 or 4, like they're all bunched together.
Yeah.
And you just rent it, and everything's there for you. All you have to do is order ingredients and get your license, and you're brewing beer. They work. And then they don't work very quickly. They're very expensive for the person who owns everything to operate because everything's decentralized as far as like how they're making their money. So they have to charge a lot.
Yeah.
So the
homebrewing is so effective now. The equipment's so great that maybe that is not necessary.
Yeah. And there's also a business model too that was like brew on site that was popular in the 90s. And I've seen some come back. I've seen some homebrew stores do it where you can go and brew a beer. And then, like, they'll package it up for you, and you can have it for your wedding or something like that. And I don't know of one that's still in existence. I don't think it's a viable business opportunity.
Okay. Gotcha.
I think a clubhouse for a brew club would be, like, more ideal because it's like, oh, yeah, I've got 20 acres, and I got a barn that I don't use. The brew club can use that. And then, you know, that could work. Whereas as soon as you start putting the business side onto it, that's where things get really sticky.
Yeah. I have a bunch of home brewers in my life that regularly have conversations about what would it look like for me to go into business, to transfer this from a hobby to a career. What's one or two questions they should ask themselves before they do that?
Wow. Okay. One, do they actually have access to the capital it takes to do it? And then two, do they know how much capital it actually takes to do it?
Okay. So it's a money question.
It's really a money question. And that's where I think we've struggled in the last two decades. This is coming from somebody who literally started a brewery of $50,000. I don't recommend that.
Yeah.
And you see so many people, because their homebrewers get really excited about it, and then they go in, and this is exactly what I did. I went into a tap room, and I looked, and I counted how many pints went across the door, or the bar top, and how many growlers went out the door. And I was like, okay, I'm charging $5 for that. I'm charging $15 for that. Okay, do the math. They just did $1,500 tonight. Cool. I know it's going to cost me $1,500 to rent this spot. I know it's going to cost me this. Okay, wow, you can do this. It makes sense. And then you start doing it, and it started being profitable fairly quickly in the hundreds of dollars range. And then I'm like, oh, wait, should I pay myself? And then all of a sudden, then you start going, okay, if I got to pay myself, I got to scale, I got to do all this. And then you're like, oh, I need a bigger brewery because I can't do this. I need help. I need this and that. So it's...
What percentage of breweries do you think people are stuck bivocationally? You go to those, like, they're almost like storage units, those like industrial mm-hmm. parks where you have those
yep, that's exactly
breweries
how
tucked
I started,
in the
yep.
garage. Yep. How many people do you think get stuck like that?
There's two ways out of that. One is growing.
Yeah.
And one is closing.
Yeah.
I started a nano brewery. It was in a garage, essentially. It was in an industrial complex. My brewery closed. I had tons of friends who started nano breweries, and we're talking in San Diego. Like, yeah. This is where, like, you opened and people showed up. They're just excited about beer yeah. 10, 15 years ago. And it just, there's a scale issue. And then the amount of labor it takes to make one pint is so much dramatically higher, and it becomes the biggest cost in making that pint mm-hmm. that as soon as you have a certain amount of people coming in, you go, I got to make more. And then all of a sudden you're going from a 40-hour, 50-hour work week to a 80, 90-hour work week because that extra revenue that you're making off of brewing that beer isn't enough to actually pay somebody to do it. Unless you want to charge $9-$10 for a pint. Yeah. And then back then it wasn't going to happen. It started happening and then people kept paying it. And then all of a sudden rents went up and the little margin that these small breweries did have disappeared. Are there opportunities to do it? Absolutely. If you own the own building, if you're in a building that you own and it's paid off, absolutely you can make it happen. That is like one of the biggest expenses is that situation. And something that you can't necessarily control. I signed a 3-year lease with a 3-year option. Well, I got 6 years into it, and then it was, hey, we got to sign another lease. Okay, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And for me, it was right at the end, so I'm just like, I'm done, we're out. And then other people I knew, dollar square foot, and then their landlord came to them, you guys look like you're successful. That'll be $3 square foot now. And they're like, guess we're closing. Because yeah. they literally, that was what they were taking home,
yeah.
was that difference.
Yeah, I think hobbies are underrated. If you enjoy doing something for the
you know
love
what?
Of it, just do
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. I agree. I think it is wonderful to have a hobby. But at the same time, I also love what I do.
Yeah.
And if I didn't have that hobby and transition it into that, I wouldn't be doing this.
Yeah.
I think it depends on the person. I think some people need a hobby, and maybe that hobby should stay a hobby because they're going to get mad that it's no longer something they enjoy. But I still enjoy it every day I come in. I think I made yeah. it through that
Introspection
one.
Probably yeah. is what you need to do.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about some beer consumption questions. What's the proper way to pour a beer?
Depends on the beer.
If I've got a big head on a beer, is that yeah. a problem?
No. If, like I said, it depends on the beer. So if you're going to pour like a German Pilsner into a big stein, you want a big fluffy head on it because it's got yeah. a lot of carbonation. You don't necessarily want to drink all that carbonation. Plus, it releases aromas and all that type of stuff. You definitely want some head on a beer. So you want to have some sort of cavitation in the glass. So you want to pour straight down a little bit, pour down the side a little bit. So it depends. Then you get into a stout. There's not a whole lot of carbonation in it. So you're going to pour it a little bit differently because it's going to foam up differently. And that
How are you going to pour a stout?
Generally speaking, you can usually pour it pretty much straight down the glass. Yeah, okay. You don't really have to worry too much about it if it's lower carbed. Yeah.
Okay. Do you think people want new things when it comes to beer? In other words, how open are people to trying new things? You don't have that person that goes to the brewery and orders the same thing every time.
Yep.
And then you got people that are like, oh, there's cheese in this. Great. Yep. Let's do it.
Yeah. That is the dilemma for most craft breweries is yeah. do I stick to my cores, my flagships was the traditional word to describe your core beers or year-round offerings, or do I just become this like niche, like everything's one-off? And there's a fine balance for everybody. So for us here, we get all every day, what's new? What's new? What's new? Is that the majority of our customers? No, but they are the most vocal.
Yeah.
So it feels like it's more. Most of our customers come in and order the same thing or the same like set of beers because yeah. that's their comfort zone. This is their place. They come in, they get one of these three or four different beers. Oh, if there's something new on that's similar, Yeah. Our bartenders would be like, hey, you should try this. This is the seasonal. And they're like, yeah, I'm drinking this for the next month. Awesome. So it really depends. I think you look at cities that are a lot more trendy with beer, they're going to want new stuff all the time.
Yeah. Like I went to the, what's the name of the brewery? I think it's called The Brewery. It's in Orange County. Yep. The Sour Place. Mm-hmm. That was incredible. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't go there every week.
No.
It's almost like a tourist attraction. You're trying all this wild beer, mm-hmm. and if I just am going in the fridge and grabbing something, I'm not going to grab one of those almost wine bottle things.
Yeah, yeah. No, I went there one time, and I just got a brown ale, and I think people looked at me weird. Like, I didn't know they had a brown ale. I think it's probably going to be pretty good, and it was. I was like, oh, okay.
Okay. Our session IPA is just pale ales with better branding.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Why do we say session IPA then?
Because it's better branding.
Okay.
Right. I think we got into this thing of like slapping IPA on anything that had hops in it because there's a group of people that like, I love craft beer because I found IPA and I love IPA and then it's got the, so I'll drink it more. The number of times I've been in a grocery store standing next to people, and I love doing this. I just love standing there. Oh, what am I going to get? And I already know what I'm going to get.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be usually what's there and go over. I know what I'm going to get, but I like standing and seeing what it is, seeing what the prices are. And then I love it when somebody comes up and is just like doing the same thing as me. And they're like, what IPA should I buy today? And then you're like, you're that guy. That's why there's 17 packs of IPA and two lagers, and I'm buying the lager.
What variables mess with your ability to provide consistency with flavor in your beer? Does that get more or less difficult at scale?
Ooh, scale helps. At scale, yeah. So at scale, there's definitely more margin for error. Going over 1 gallon on a 300-gallon batch is not as troublesome as going over 1 gallon on a 10-gallon batch, right?
Yeah.
So there's some of that helps us. And at scale, usually the equipment you're working on is worth a lot more and it got new technology in it. So there's definitely consistency things that benefit you at scale.
Okay.
The problems at scale are generally going to be ingredients and the biological process of fermentation, making sure that your yeast is as healthy this time as was the previous time, making sure that the grain is coming from the same supplier with all the same specs. You're getting the right amount of sugar out of it, making sure the hops have the right type of, and then every year they change because there's a new growing season. So then you have to look at them and go, oh, hey, last year this hop made my beer more bitter, or this year now it's making it more bitter, so I have to use less. Oh, now I've got less flavor, so now I have to add in a different hop that's similar that doesn't have as much bittering components, and then the beer changes a little bit. Or the bitterness is fine, but then all of a sudden one year there's a fire 200 miles away from the hop farm and a little smoke got into it. Like, oh, now I can't use that hop anymore. So I got to go buy it from New Zealand or something like that.
How much of this do you think consumers notice? Like the small variations in a batch.
Oh, they absolutely notice it, but they don't understand why it's happening.
Okay.
I definitely get it batch to batch. It actually happened. Our hazy IPA, we switched over from using, I think it was in 2023, we switched over from using 2022 hops to fresh 2023 hops. So every fall is when the harvest is. I usually get fresh hops starting in about November. First batch of new hops, somebody comes over, it's like, new batch is different. I'm like, yeah, it's New Year's hops. You're like, no, I like it. It's just different. I'm like, yep, and it's going to be that way for the next year. Because that's, and I'm like,
it's like the session IPA. Just say, oh, it's something new and interesting we're trying. Versus
variations. Yeah.
What is your favorite German beer flavor-wise, and why do you think they taste better in the Alps?
It tastes better in the Alps. Usually it's amber lager, so Vienna lager, like a Märzen. That malty lager is usually my favorite. And it probably tastes better in the Alps because I'm really far away from all the stresses of my life.
Yeah, there you go. Do you think we've reached a cul-de-sac in innovation in certain beers? I'm obviously referencing hazies where they've just been, the market's so saturated. Do you think there's still room to innovate, or we reached a limit where we just need to start looking at different kinds of beers to innovate?
I always try to be an optimist and say there's always room for innovation for something that's good. I think a lot of the innovation in that, especially in hazies, has been not as good. I think I'm guilty of it too. Let's throw some fruit in there. Oh no. That's really what I did, is I made a fruit beer and then I threw some extra hops in it and called it an IPA.
Yeah.
So we get back to the session IPA thing. It's good branding to call things IPA. Well, have our hazy strawberry that we have on tap, and you drink it, you're like, well, this is like a strawberry beer. Because it is a strawberry beer. There's a lot of strawberries in it because it tastes like strawberries. That was the point. But the base of it, we did brew as a hazy. But the strawberries took over. So why am I throwing all these hops at it? But if you don't throw the hops at it, then I feel guilty calling it an IPA. So I do put the hops in there. But other people don't feel guilty about doing that, and they just throw IPA in there because there's no regulations controlling what India Pale Ale means.
Okay. So what you're saying is, it's just the name, but we can do all sorts of things under the guise of the
Absolutely.
Name.
And I think when we start doing things and innovating, and then you look at, hey, this is really cool. I made this really cool new product that people like. And then you go, how do I market this so people actually understand generally what it is? And so fruited IPA, milkshake IPA is another great example, right? Milkshake IPA was actually interesting because it took a process that you usually use for stouts and you added it to an IPA. You're like, well, usually this creaminess isn't really work with bitterness. And then they're like, well, we took the bitterness out. So it's just the hop, like fruit and character and floralness and all the citrusness. And you're like, okay, that's like a creamsicle kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I can get that. And then, but then they left IPA on it. That's not an India pale ale. I'm sorry. First of all, it's not pale.
Yeah.
It's definitely not from England or India. So like, why are we calling it India pale ale? It's because it sells better.
And you don't want some kind of governing body restricting the parameters of something, because then you
sometimes
just...
Sometimes I do.
Sometimes you do?
Yeah, sometimes
I do,
because I
so
go to...
So what's the trade-offs with that, though? Because it limits innovation in some ways, right?
In some ways, but I think it also allows us to describe the product more accurately so people understand what it is. Because one of the struggles we have, especially with the IPA category that I see in our tap room and I see when I'm standing next to guys at the grocery store, is they see Hazy Little Thing, right? I think that's Sierra Nevada.
Yeah.
And... I always get that in Firestone Walker's confused because they look almost identical. Yeah,
they might taste similar.
Yeah, probably because it's the same hops that we all use for these beers now.
Yeah.
And they go, that's an IPA. And then they'll see Stone IPA, and they haven't seen Stone IPA in a shelf in years. And like, I used to drink that too. And then they'll get it and they'll drink it. And they'll go, oh God, I can't drink this. This is terrible. So, no, it's just different. But they both have the IPA moniker on it. So part of me is somebody needs to do something, but also the part of me is then we're just inviting trouble. Because then somebody who has no idea what they're even talking about is going to start setting regulations. Then you're like, now they can only be 7 to 7.5% because that's the style guideline. And they're just like, no, we do it by the stuff.
Yeah.
So I would tend to agree that we shouldn't have anybody regulating that stuff. But I wish we would self-regulate a little bit more.
Yeah.
Because, a milkshake IPA isn't an IPA.
Yeah.
A fruited IPA isn't, especially a fruited hazy, isn't really an IPA. But here I am, fruited hazy, right there on tap. So you know what? It is what it is. Yeah.
Do you think people want higher percentage beers these days?
Ooh, not so much. I think we've come down from that. We still get it. What's your highest ABV on tap?
Yeah.
And then my favorite thing to go, it's this one, and it's $16 for 10 ounces of it. And then they're like, I'll have the next one down. Because they're looking for bang for their buck.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, bang for your buck really isn't the craft beer segment. It's an elevated product. It's not... Cobra, it's not Steel Reserve, it's not,
which is interesting because if you think of someone that goes and buys a 24 of Coors, like what's the percentage on that? What's ABV?
Coors is usually like 5%, 4.5%. I've definitely seen that trend, especially here, having brewed now in three different beer markets. There's definitely a trend in the beer drinkers in the Fresno area that they're more into just beer, like the blondes, pilsners, lagers that are 4 to 5%. They can have a couple of them and be good. And then there's still people who are like, I like a good IPA because it's a little stronger. It gives me, I can have two of them and I don't feel it in them, and I'll get a little buzz or whatever if that's important to them.
How would you describe the way to achieve a balance in a beer? Like, what does balance mean to you in terms of beer?
Balance to me means drinkability.
Okay.
So if you're having a beer and it's hitting the style guidelines and somebody wants to go back and have it again, then you've hit the balance for that style. Because if it's too sweet for that style, they're probably not going to go back to it. If it's too bitter for that style, they're not going to go back. If it's too much flavor, they're not going to go back. Like, if I want Bud Light, and somebody hands me a Cobra, like malt liquor, it's way sweeter. And you're like, oh, that's not what I want. I want Coors Light. I want something light and crazy. So when it comes to living within the style guidelines, finding that sweet spot of drinkability where you're hitting the notes, but you're not over the top on any of them, and that's where you find that balance.
On that same note, and we touched on this for a second, but let's dig in. How do you know if you've overdone a fruit? Let me give you an example. And I'm going to really appreciate one of your beers right now. Your coconut beer.
Mm-hmm.
It's the cocoa... It's Daycay.
So it's Daycation, because Fresno, you can basically take a Daycation anywhere in California. Yeah. I think that's the first time I've ever explained that to anybody, and most people are like, I don't understand it. But
So that's one of my favorite beers you guys do.
Cool.
Because it's something that's easy. It's something that it's not a high ABV, so I can have a couple just working on something in the backyard.
Yep.
I don't think about it. And it's got that kind of perfect balance of coconut. But I also know, I've also had beers that, not from you guys necessarily, but where the fruit is, it's like orange juice.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, I need an element of bitter here in order to make it. There's one that I think Sierra Nevada put out. It's like some like cosmic something is in the name.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just juice. It's just juice. And I have one of them. I'm like, okay, that's all I want. Now give me something. Give me a really bitter beer.
Yeah, so we've gone away from balance, right?
Yeah.
You're seeing something like, I want a fruit beer.
Yeah.
So there should be beer in the fruit.
Yeah.
And that's always that's usually where I start with that is, okay, we're making a fruit beer. So it should still taste like beer. It should just be recognizable beer, but it should have a fruit character to it.
Mm.
And then it comes down to the palate of the person who's approving it at the end of the day. and that's where you tend to find you like one brewery more than the others, because at the end of the day, there's usually one person or like a small committee. Usually it's the brewmaster, right, or the owner who's, yep, this is something I'll put my name on, put it out there. And you will get to know breweries, and you're like, I like going there because I like everything they make. And it's because your palate is very aligned to the person at the who quality controls it and makes sure that the balance that they see is the balance that is in the class. Mm-hmm. And then you like that balance, so you relate to it. So sometimes people are like, I don't know why that person's so successful. Their beer is just whatever. It's no, they're successful because you think their beer is whatever, but all the people buying it are in tune with that person's perception of what the beer should be.
I see. Is there any trade-offs to using lactose when you're brewing, like in terms of the beer quality? Does it require a lot more kind of control and precision using some kind of milk product? I'm thinking about milkshake
IPAs.
No,
so the products, the lactose that we get is fairly refined and very consistent. Okay. Once you understand, okay, I can use this much per gallon, that you usually live in that area and you know those kind of information's readily available. Usually for a 5-gallon batch of a home brewer, it's usually about a pound. So you scale that up and you look at my batches, which are 10 barrels, which are 300 gallons, and I'm putting about 50 pounds of lactose in it, which is about a little less than a pound like you would for a homebrew batch. So it's pretty consistent on that side because the product is so consistent. It's just, yeah, really refined and consistent product. So it's fairly easy to use.
Okay. How many lagers are actually just golden ales?
Hopefully zero.
Okay.
But some people mislabel their products.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I know that to make a lager, it requires a lot more time than a golden ale. And so I've heard some brewers complain about mislabeling things, and it's just out of laziness.
Yeah. So
so you don't think that actually it really exists in the marketplace?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's definitely people who label lagers or pilsners or something, and they actually, there are ales.
Yeah. And can you distinguish that for us? What's the actual
difference? Yeah. So I think that's important. So there's two different types of yeast that ferment beer. And so it breaks it down into two different categories, ale and lager. Lagers are traditionally colder fermenting yeast strains, so they developed in Bavaria and that part of the world where they were store the beer cold, and so it would take a little bit longer. The yeast, just like lizards, is more active at the higher temperatures.
Okay.
Ale yeast ferments at a higher temperature. Some people say top fermenting and bottom fermenting. The yeast ferments in solution, so it's not really top or bottom. But typically speaking, when it's colder, the yeast kind of settle towards the bottom, so if they're dying or they're just done, they're on the bottom. And whereas with ale fermentation, it gets very vigorous and they bubble up to the surface. There's some great video you can look up of Sierra Nevada's brewing their Hefeweizen, and they use giant open vats for it. And you can actually see it, like all the krausen is what it's called. It's all this foamy, yeasty stuff goes to the top. You don't see a lot of that on lager because it's colder, so the metabolism rate's a lot lower. Plus, they're distinctly two different like genomes. Like, we actually looked at them and they're actually different. So they've been selectively bred from what was the original brewer's yeast. And I don't know where I was going with that exactly, but those are the two different things. And so lagers take longer because the metabolism rate is slower and they produce different flavors at those temperatures. You can absolutely use an ale yeast to do a lager in a way, but it's going to take it's going to take longer times, and you're not going to get the flavor that's right. And again, it's not the yeast that's designed for that. So you're going to taste it. This doesn't taste like a lager. What it is it's like a Kolsch. I don't know if you're too familiar with German beer styles, but Kolsch is a cold fermented ale. And then there's the exact opposite, which is like Anchor Steam, is a warm fermented lager. So it uses lager yeast, but they ferment it like an ale. Kolsch uses an ale yeast and they ferment it like lager. So there is that play in the market. But then, so you often see most breweries brew ale because they can put the beer in the tank and 2 weeks later they can have a beer. Lager takes a lot longer to hit that finish, so you're looking at 4 to 6 weeks. So money-wise, space-wise, I can get 3 beers done in the same amount of time with one tank.
Yeah.
If I'm spending $20,000 on a tank, So I'm going to brew an ale. And so that's why usually you see ales as the predominant thing that you're going to see in craft beer world. And some people are dishonest or don't care. And so they look at a nice blonde ale. So like our Clovis Avenue, 4.5%, put it right next to Bud, and Bud will probably look a little lighter, but they're both filtered, they're whatever. They're
there's
kind of
not
the same,
beer right? inspectors going around trying this.
And
not,
so they're like,
yeah,
it's like, just call it a lager because people, again, we get back to the IPA thing. Is it really an IPA? If you take the actual definition of an IPA, absolutely not. But people know what it is. They're like, oh, it's a lager. Oh, so it'll be light and refreshing. And people hear stout and they're like, oh, it's going to be strong and dark. And like, well, Guinness has less calories than Budweiser. So is it really that big and robust? No, it's not. It's actually a light beer, but it's not colored like a light beer.
Do you think it's wise financially as a brewery to have a ton of sours on the menu?
It depends. Okay. If it's the reason you're there, As a brewer, then yeah, absolutely. Because otherwise, you're not going to get up in the morning and do the rest of your job. I think it's a niche market, and it's tough to sell that type of stuff.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean you can't do it in a way that makes money for you. Like
every 100 customers, how many do you think are ordering a sour when they step in your
brewery? So the type of sours that we do, we go through kegs of it every month. No problem. We just came out with two. We did a collaboration brew with Hop Forge in Hanford, mm-hmm. and with another sour. And we go and we have people when we don't have them on. Oh, do you not have a sour? But these aren't like the ones that sit in barrels for 2-3 years that eat up a ton of space and ton of time and ton of money. These are much quicker, done in the kettle. We use similar bacteria, but it's a lot more sanitary, so I'm not infecting all of my equipment and all that type of stuff. And so we can turn those a little bit faster, and usually they're fruited, and that's what people are looking for in that. And yeah, we go through quite a bit of it.
Okay. How interesting are seltzers to you? Are they boring?
They're incredibly boring. Yeah. That was what I was just doing.
Yeah.
I was
Tell us why they're boring.
Because at the end of the day, you're going for literally as close to zero flavor as possible. You want as neutral a base in the fermentation process so that when you add flavor to it, you don't have to add a ton of flavor to it to get where you're going, so that you can maintain the cost of it and then lower the caloric intake of it. Because a lot of people who drink seltzers, it's about, okay, I can get a Truly's and it's 100 calories at 5%, but a Budweiser, which is also 5%, is like 140 calories.
Do you think it's expanding the market, getting more GB3
Absolutely.
People coming in?
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it is, and I think it's important. I think it's part of diversifying your beverage portfolio as a brewery. That's why we do it.
Yeah.
As a brewer, I find it boring.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I've got this cool blank slate that I can do interesting stuff with. And so we're trying to do that right now. We've definitely done some recently, and we're getting more into that. I think locally there are some breweries doing some really interesting things with a seltzer base that make it more interesting than just, say, a White Claw or a Truly's. It's just flavored alcoholic water.
Yeah,
but
at the end of the day.
Here, maybe there's people using more natural ingredients, not necessarily extracts and stuff. They're using real fresh fruit or adding different types of herbs and spices to it that make it just a little bit more interesting. And I think people are going to have responded to that. If you just go to Crow and Wolf and you see how many seltzers go over their board, and I think you realize that, yeah, it's here to stay. It's not going anywhere, but you got to find what's right for you and for your customers.
Yeah, my wife is devoted to the Dark Horse, which it's a great seltzer.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I wouldn't go to a brewery for a seltzer. If someone poured that in front of me, I would drink it.
Yeah, I've had it poured in front of me, and I've drank it plenty of times.
All right, we're going to jump into my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to throw a bunch of things at you, and you just tell me whether you think they're over or underrated and why.
Okay.
You're free to pass on any of these. Okay. First one, Untappd, over underrated?
Oh, both.
Okay, why?
Because there are certain things on there that people overrate, and there are certain things on there that people underrate.
But the business itself, using social media to rate beers, do you think that's over or underrated?
It's funny, because on the professional side, we definitely don't think highly of Untappd. And so I would say we overrate it, or underrate it.
Overrated is like
it's a good thing,
lots
right?
Of people like it, but
we don't like it, and I think there's a fair point to that. But at the same time, I understand why a consumer would like it.
Yeah.
And I think for a consumer, I think it doesn't seem to be over or under. For a brewer, it's probably overrated.
Okay.
Yeah.
Next one, Athletic Brewing, the NA beer company.
Oh, I know people who work there.
Yeah. You think they're over or underrated in terms of their beer?
That's tricky. I get in conversations with them all the time.
Yeah. Let's branch off from that. What do you think of the NA beer market?
I don't think it's beer.
Okay.
Because it doesn't have alcohol in it. And I think alcohol is intrinsic to the flavor properties of beer.
Because I've experimented, do a dry month every once in a while.
Yeah.
And
I do too. I do twice a year.
And I try some of them. I'm just like, this is just like hoppy tea.
Yeah.
And some of them are even just called like hop tea.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I would rather have like hop seltzer. So we got a friend who has a hop seltzer company in town, and we stock it here at the brewery. And I love drinking those. Those are great because it gives me the kind of like that hop kick that I'm looking for, and there's no alcohol in it, and there's no calories, and it's great. I think NA beers in general, they play a role. Like, I know my grandfather used to get them all the time when he was in his 80s because he wasn't supposed to have alcohol anymore, but he likes the flavor.
Yeah.
So I think there's a place for them. But people who don't drink anymore because they're alcoholics or something like that, usually it's triggering for them is what I've heard from these people. So they avoid them. And then people who are like, oh, I do it because I don't want to drink alcohol, but I like the flavor. Perfect. Awesome. Yeah. It works for you. But people are like, oh, I it's less calories. It is and it isn't. Like
you're still like 100 calories,
yeah,
80, something
you're right,
like that.
Because they're still a fermented product and they still use malt and all that type of stuff. It just they take the alcohol out.
I think for me it's similar to like vegan cheese, where you're like, oh, this
it's not
something.
Cheese.
It's not cheese. It's a cheese-like product.
Yes.
Maybe.
Yeah. So I think what they are, I think they're good. I think as beer, they're overrated.
Okay.
Yeah.
Me and Ed's Pizza.
Underrated. I like Me and Ed's
okay.
Pizza. Yeah.
All right. You're a transplant like me. Yeah. So what do you like about it?
Yeah. It reminds me of some of the pizza that I grew up eating in San Diego, where it's I like the dough and there's tons of toppings on it and it's a little bit messy because it falls apart and yeah.
Awesome. The 120-minute IPA by Dogfish Head.
Ooh, I've only had it like twice.
Okay.
So
or Dogfish Head in general. They've got the 90, the 60, the 30.
Yeah, I love some of their other IPAs, but I would say 120 is overrated.
Okay. Because it's like $32 for a four-pack
or
something
like
that?
Yeah, so that's where the overrating comes in. If it was like $16 for a four-pack, then I'd be like, yeah, that's a great beer. Because it is. But at the same time, I'm not spending $32 on a four-pack.
Yeah. How important was Dogfish Head in the craft world? I remember being in college in the mid-2000s, and we would go to a convenience store, and it was like Dogfish Head and Anchor Steam and a few other things.
I remember going to Tap Takeovers, where it was like Dogfish Head's in town, and like Sam actually might be there, and it was like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
I think incredibly important. Yeah. No, I think they're maybe underrated on their impact on craft beer because they made craft beer super cool and artsy, super hipstery, right? Oh, we went to Sam Calone, like, we went to every continent on the planet and got an ingredient and made this beer. And you're like, that is the cheesiest thing. All right, give me some. That'll be $16. Okay, fine. And then
Arthur and I were talking about this for Full Circle, and I was telling him that it was an event when we would go to a corner store and find Midas Touch in there, which was there. I don't even know what it was, to be honest. It was just like,
it's an ancient ale, right?
Yeah. And it was just like, it was like a, almost like a religious ceremony. We would crack open one of those, which I loved. Next one, beer sommeliers.
So Cicerones.
Cicerones, yeah.
So they have their own name.
Yeah, okay.
Undervalued, underrated. Absolutely. Okay. I think because
there's less of like, you're not dealing with vintages and things like that in the wine world. You can be, but what's their value?
Education.
Okay.
So we talked about styles and IPAs being mislabeled and lagers and all that type of stuff. These are the people who are educated on the topic who can correctly inform consumers about what they're actually drinking and why diversity is important and why, traditionally that's not an IPA. And then they go to the store, they go, what type of IPA is it? Yeah. And then the consumer gets pickier and demands more information from, I go to a store and I see just simply, it just says IPA. Yeah. I'm not going to buy it because I have no idea what it is.
Right.
But if something's hazy IPA brewed with Mosaic and Simcoe hops, I'm like, okay, I know where I'm going with that. I think I'm going to enjoy that, right? When we educate our consumers, they buy with that education and they force us to become better. So I think it's really important.
I think, and I agree with you, I wonder where they work because you have high-end restaurants in every city that can employ a wine sommelier.
Yep.
Because if they're going to buy, they convince some rich goober that's coming in there to buy a $400 bottle.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's returns on that for the business.
Yep.
Beer, you're not selling expensive. You're selling a glass.
Cicerone seems to be more of a self-improvement thing and something like a certification you can tack onto a resume. I know a lot of certified Cicerones. I know some people he keeps trying to go for his master Cicerone and he keeps getting like 88% and he gets a 90% on the test.
Did you watch that movie Psalm, where the guys go and try to become master sommeliers or whatever it is?
No.
You should watch that. Yeah. It's incredible. And I respect the knowledge. The work seems just unbearable.
Yeah. I'm fairly competent. I'm a certified judge and all that, which is another aspect of it. The Cicerone kind of works more towards food pairings and service, right? Whereas the BJCP, Beer Judge Certificate Program, they work more towards quality control, process development, and ingredients. But for people I know, that some of the bigger breweries, they push some of their front of house staff through those programs. Because again, it's about educating your consumers. For a tap room, for a brewery, it's our showroom.
Yeah.
So you're coming to the Ford showroom. A tap room, like down the street, that's just a retailer, right? That's just a guy who sells cars, but we're a place where we're actually showing you all of our products and we're trying to sell them, not just here, but everywhere. We have to educate people. Come into a Ford dealership, to a certain extent, and you're like, I want an F-150. They're like, which one do you want? I know the specs on every single F-150. And then you walk out of there with the one that's got an extra $30,000 package because the guy convinced you, so there's your value.
Okay. Next one, PBR.
PBR. Ooh, underrated.
Yeah, tell me why. When's a good time for a PBR?
Good time for PBR. So it's like my between a craft beer and between drinking like a 30 rack of Coors Light.
Yeah.
So if I'm like, I know I'm just going to have like a couple of beers at a picnic, PBR is a great choice.
Yeah.
Because it's a little hoppier. It's a little bit bolder of a light American lager than a lot of the stuff out there. And I like the yeast profile that they use more so than some of the other brands. So,
what's your favorite big mass market beer that you would find in every gas station in the United States?
Miller Lite.
Miller Lite?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm a Coors guy.
I'm a Miller Coors. So if I'm out and it's like the choice between all the light beers, it's like Miller Lite or Coors Lite are going to be my choices. I actively avoid Anheuser-Busch, especially the Budweiser products. I don't like the yeast they use. It gives this taste that I don't care for.
Yeah.
It's still well made, but it's just not my thing. But Coors and so High Life and Miller Lite and then Banquet and Coors Light. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Give me a gold Millie. I'm set. Next one. And this is going away. Beers in bottles. Do you think that's over or underrated? You see a lot more cans these days.
Yes, absolutely. I think cans were underrated for the longest time. Now I think cans are a little overrated, and I think bottles are underrated. I think there's something...
Isn't there some problems with putting beer in bottles?
Yes. The problems that come with bottles is obviously the light and oxygen. So the two biggest problems you have with beer stability on a shelf is heat, cold, that swings, and then oxygen. So in a bottle, there's actually more room for oxygen in there. And then obviously they're clear, so light comes through. So when you switch over to cans, you eliminate there's less space on the top, there can be, for oxygen. And then at the same time, there's no light coming in. So you have technically a more stable product that if it sits out, it's not going to go as bad as quickly. But then we start getting into long-term storage, and you go, there's a BPI, whatever it is, liner on it that will degrade over time and then leach into your beer. So now you're drinking microplastics. Is that ideal? Glass doesn't have that issue.
Yeah.
Then you go, there's this classic study about wine, and there's a bunch of wine judges, and they printed out new labels and put wine into different bottles, and they gave it to them, and it was literally like the same four wines, and they kept giving it to them in different packages. The quality of the wine had nothing to do with how the judges rated it. It all came down to how well what the package looked like influenced what they perceived the product was out of it. I think there's some class to bottles. I think there's some use to bottles, especially for aging beers.
Sure.
Also, there's something I just love about popping a bottle cap and drinking out of a bottle of beer while you're outside doing something that is way more satisfying than drinking out of a can.
Yeah.
So
it is nostalgic. It feels nostalgic.
Yeah, exactly. I remember going to Ballast Point when Sculpin first came out, and they had their first six pack, and that was the only way you could get it. You couldn't get it in a can, and you had to pay $15 for a six pack of Sculpin in 2010, which just seems ridiculous now. Yeah. And I just have. Yeah, drinking out of a bottle was there's some nostalgia for me. So I say bottles are underrated, but the market loves. And the other thing is the distributors love cans because they fit on a shelf better.
Yeah,
they take up less space, they ship better.
So it's grocery store elements too.
Exactly, and it's very complicated. But as a consumer, I really do enjoy bottles.
Yeah, I remember sitting in the back of a truck with an Arrogant Bastard, and it always came in a bottle.
Oh, I miss Bombers. Nobody does 22-ounce bottles anymore.
No, they
don't. And mind you, they were a great price point for breweries because it was...
Like the tall cans, but it's not the same.
Yeah. And then there's a perceived value in a bigger bottle than there is in a bigger can. You're like, oh, yeah, you go get a tall boy, and it's got to be $3 or $4 for you to really look. You're not looking at a $9 one, but it's like, see, a bottle, the same thing. It's a couple more ounces more, but it's in a bottle. So, I'll spend it.
Next one, Beer Moses.
Underrated. I love beer moses.
Okay.
Especially with the right beer.
Yeah, what's the right beer? That was my next question.
So I like using wheat beer.
Okay.
Because it's usually a little more effervescent.
Okay.
Usually there's, and then it the body kind of works with the fruit.
Okay.
And it's, I think, fruit and wheat just go really well together in beers, so I like using. Like a wit beer is awesome, or a Hefeweizen to do a beer mosa, I think it's great.
Yeah. What's your favorite non-California brewery?
Ooh.
Deschutes.
Yeah. I've been there. It's awesome. Yeah. They make great beer. Some of their like just six pack beer, like Mir Ponds and Black Butte. You don't see them as often as you could. And then when I do see them, they're like 6 months old, and I get depressed. But if I see fresh on tap, I'm usually buying. Deschutes is awesome.
What's the name of the brewery that does the Dragon's Milk? That was a big thing for me.
Oh yeah, they're out of Michigan.
New Holland.
Yeah. I've had a lot of Dragon Milk because I've got a buddy who owns a brewery in Detroit and is a member of the guild, and so I've met some of those people.
They make
great beer too.
Yeah. I love that white stout. That's my favorite thing. I wish I could see that more. I don't know if it's complicated.
You gotta have my.
You have a white stout.
Yeah, it's called The Cake Is a Lie.
Okay.
It's from my old brewery.
I'm looking at one beer right now, so we'll talk about that in a second. Stemmed beer glasses, over underrated.
Ooh.
When you get one, you feel fancy.
Yeah,
you know?
I love them, but I think they're a little overrated. Because I think you can get all the same things out of a unstemmed glass, and then they don't break, and then they're not as costly.
Yeah.
But gosh, they look cool, don't they?
Yeah.
Ballast Point. My early days in craft beer were all in San Diego. Yeah. Ballast Point when they switched over from going from a shaker pint, which I don't like shaker pints for beer because they're designed to shake cocktails.
Yeah.
So they switched from those to a 16-ounce like stemmed glass, and I'm like, oh, this is fancy. This is really cool.
What do you call these glasses?
So these are actually designed for craft beer. I don't know that Libby. It's just they're big, but they're actually craft beer glasses. So they're thinner. Helps. Let's let it warm up a little bit because craft beer should be drank a little bit warmer than it's served, and then they help curtail.
Yeah, the kind of hour
the hourglass shape, so it holds some of that aromas in. So while you open your mouth, you're smelling at the same time. You get a little more of aroma punch. Whereas the shaker glass is just straight out, and that aroma just flies out of the glass.
Gotcha. Okay, a few more in this section. Slurpee beers. Everyone's making Slurpees out of beers. What do you think?
Oh, it's so overrated.
Tell me why.
It's not beer. It's okay. Alcoholic slushies, and those are perfectly fine. Yeah. But you start saying beer, and then I have a problem. Yeah.
Okay. Beer tenders, customer service. Like, how important is customer service for you? I've been in breweries where they're just like, fuck you want, and then they just slide you a beer. And then I've been in places where they just ask me preferences. So I've had an array.
Yeah.
I don't know if one, they both have their romanticism about being insulted by your bartender a little bit.
Yeah, that's the dive bar thing, right? Yeah. So if you've got a dive bar brewery,
yeah,
go for it.
Yeah,
but I definitely think customer service is definitely underrated. You walk into a place and you have questions, and then they don't get answered.
Yeah.
You leave that place with those questions. But if you walk into a place and you have questions and they get answered, then you start asking more questions, and then you learn about things, and then you become more attached to it. So the best thing you can have is just an absolutely killer staff that is incredibly knowledgeable. Cicerone, right?
Yeah.
Where somebody comes in, they have beer questions, and they can get all the answers. That's wonderful, and they feel comfortable there.
Okay. Whiskey or mezcal?
Whiskey.
Okay. Barrel age or steel?
For
whatever.
Barrel age. That means more flavor.
Okay. But, all right. So we're going to jump into some beer business questions now. There's a lot of taxes that breweries have to deal with.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how that impacts your business? And what would you, if you could sit in a room with a bunch of legislators and articulate the challenges that all the different regulations and taxes and all the different rules that operate or designate how you operate, what would you ask them to change about the system as it is?
So actually, the last couple of years, they've actually done a pretty good job changing some of the things. So the primary taxes that breweries face, obviously, just like any other business, we have sales tax that we add on to beer. And then if there's any sort of local sales tax or something like that, then they have that. Then there's usually states will have their individual alcohol taxes. So we pay taxes to the state of California for the alcohol we produce, and to the federal government was charging craft breweries the same rate as they were large breweries for the longest time. Then they're like, okay, it doesn't make sense to charge $8.50 a keg to small businesses because that literally could be the difference in making money or not.
Yeah.
So they dropped it down and it ended up being $7, which is significantly different because and then they dropped it even more and they went down to $3.50 or something like that recently. And those things definitely freed up money for a brewery of our size. So you pay $7 for every barrel. Say we're doing 1,000 barrels, that's $7,000 a year.
Yeah.
Okay. That'll help. Absolutely.
Sure.
But then you go to a brewery like Ballast Point or Sierra Nevada, and they're in that range where, dropping that literally means hundreds of thousands of dollars. They can hire more people. And in those smaller businesses, they're medium-sized businesses at that point, right?
Yeah.
But they're literally going to use that money to hire people.
I see.
Because they need the help. Or give people raises. Because craft beer is notorious for undervaluing their employees. So I would just sit down and go, what do you need this money for? What is it going towards? But at the same time, we've had those conversations and it has come back down because they realize that smaller breweries struggle with that, whereas the bigger breweries it's a little easier because they have the volume to pass that cost on without huge problems for consumers.
Does your average craft brewery charge enough for beer?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
I think the average craft brewery charges too much for beer.
Oh really? So
yeah.
What do you think is the ideal price point so you can get the margins so your business is sustainable?
Let's start with this. I can make a pint of beer for less than 50 cents.
Those are excellent margins.
That's not my biggest cost.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
My biggest cost is making it.
Yeah.
So I cost significantly more than the ingredients to produce the beer that we make.
Sure.
My staff costs more than the cost, right? So that's where the price of the pint is really coming from. I've got rent, that has skyrocketed in the last 10 years. I've got, not taxes, taxes have actually come down a little bit, like I just talked about, but rent, cost of my employees. When I started in this industry, minimum wage was like $8.95 or something like that in the state of California. 10 years later, it's $16.50. Right? So we've literally doubled the cost of, and I'm not to say that I don't want to pay those people that type of stuff. You're in a market where everybody is trying to bring in a lower price point to attract more people, so they're going to drive it down, and the only way you can compete is by driving it down, so you have to stagnate wages, unfortunately.
Yeah. How much should we charge for a pint in a craft brewery?
I would love to see it where we're at $5-6 for a pint, because I think it can be profitable there.
Oh, really? Because I mean, it's 7 to 9 right now, and depending on where
you
are,
yeah, absolutely.
Right?
I mean, we start at $7.25.
Yeah.
And go up to $8.50, right?
Okay.
And the difference between $7.25 and $8.50 is purely ingredient cost. So I've got beers that cost 35, 40 cents a pint, and I've got beers that cost about 80 cents a pint. So when I have those differences, that's where we add the extra 25, 50
sure.
cents.
Okay.
But when it comes to all those expenses, the ones I was talking about, so for a brewery like Sierra Nevada, they can absolutely charge $5 a pint in their tap room, because they're still making, they're making great money off that, because all those expenses are lower, because they're spent, they're charging that, the price that they're sending a can out to their distributor for way less, and they're making money off that, right?
Yeah.
But they can charge $7-8, so they're going to, right? So I'd love to see some pullback on it, because I think we're getting a little fatigue on how much craft, because I think beer should be a lot more approachable. Beer is the drink of the people,
yeah,
and it needs to be more approachable, and we've gotten away from beer, craft beer in particular, being financially approachable. And you can go and get Coors Light, you can get a 30 rack for $22 or something like that, and you're like, why is it 22? Like, we sell a 4-pack of hazy IPA for $22.
Yeah.
And I know, like, for us, like, that margin sucks, because our labor making that is terrible. So, like, we're comfortable at that price. We're probably comfortable at a couple bucks less too.
Yeah.
But everybody else is at the same price, so we're like, we're not gonna under
make less money.
Yeah, we're not gonna throw away $2,000 a year because of $2.
Yeah. And my sister-in-law lives in Alpine, which is East County, San Diego.
Yep.
And there's a grocery store down the road from them, and it's got a wonderful beer section.
I think I know the grocery store.
And I bet you do. And I spend a lot of money in that beer section, where I'll get a 4-pack for $28.
Yep.
And the guy next to me in line has got a 24-pack of Coors.
For $17.99,
yeah. It's a weird world. Do you think that brewery districts can work in every city, or do you think you need like a large population concentrated of young professionals to make them make sense?
I think there's so many variables at play with that it's really hard to answer.
Yeah, yeah. What's your gut feeling though?
It can work. Because I think you look at districts in most major cities that are nightlife and drinking areas.
Yeah.
And those are very vibrant and great, and you can build a good time there. And you can put 4 or 5 breweries in that area and not have a problem, because there's enough people down there. So you look at San Diego. North Park is a perfect example of that. I think you could even look down here on Fulton Street and see, yeah, there's a number of bars and then breweries in the brewery district here. Are they all doing great? I don't know.
This is where I have to bring up the elephant in the room. I was just down on Fulton Street and I was watching the mural at Full Circle be sprayed off with a power hose because they're closing up shop there. And it makes me think, like, what can the brewery district handle and hold, and how many operators can exist there?
And that's, I think, city dependent. I think I think Fresno, unfortunately, has a phobia of going downtown. Yeah. I think there's really a lot of energy against the downtown area in Fresno, because it has been so underwhelming for so long and crime ridden and dilapidated and all that. And a lot of that is changing. We did a beer festival with the Guild in October, and it was at Eaton Plaza.
Yeah, right across the street from the library and the police
absolutely.
Department.
Absolutely. And literally, we're next to the police department. It was absolutely a wonderful, beautiful day. The lawn was manicured perfectly fine. Like, it was like there's parking, and there's nothing about that as somebody who didn't grow up with any sort of stigma that downtown Fresno is terrible. I grew up with downtown San Diego, which, by the way, I went to in high school, and it wasn't pleasant.
Yeah.
But now it's everybody looks at, like, downtown San Diego, the Gas Lamp and the Embarcadero and Seaport
Aspirational.
Village and Petco Park area. Absolutely exactly what every city should be doing. And Fresno's trying to do it. They got the baseball park down there, they got the brewery district, they're building, they're renovating, they're doing things. It takes time, but it also takes investment and a lot of encouragement from local.
Do you think it's just because people can't take Ubers from downtown? And so if you're going to go drink down there,
I think public transit's also important,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
When I was living in Clovis, it'd be $30 just one way to go downtown.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I'm going to go downtown and spend $9 on an IPA or four. So I'm like, okay, do I have $150 to go out tonight? And the answer to that is, no, I'm going to go get a $22 rack or a $22.30 rack of Coors Light and some hot dogs, and I'm going to be good for $40 at home. But at the same time, there are people who do have that expendable money, and we definitely heard some stuff. It's like, oh, I've heard about it. I'd love to go, but I don't like going downtown Fresno. It's literally the nicest part of downtown Fresno, and you walk around, it's like there was
you go to Dab Tacos, you go to Modernist, get a cocktail, get a beer. Yeah,
so absolutely. I think there's definitely hurdles that have to be overcome in that sense, where you have to change the perception.
Yeah.
And then you get the people there. I mean, go to 6th Street in Austin, Texas, and it's literally bar, pizza place. Every bar has music. Every bar has $2, and when I was in college, $2 shooters.
Yeah.
And there's people everywhere all over that street, and you're like, how does every one of these bars still alive? And there's 50 of them in like a 2-block span, and it's because it is a place to go. You have to build a place to go.
Yeah.
And then it can handle it. But at the moment, is it a place to go? It's a place to go to Tioga Sequoia right now. Tioga Sequoia doesn't do bad. Procreations is doing okay down the road there. You got up the road is south of Shaw, and they're doing really well, seems. It's starting.
Yeah.
And I think for full circle, my understanding is just that they just wanted to consolidate back to their a half a mile away. And like, why are we moving all this? We're right here. We used to have our big parties here. I worked there for a little while during COVID, filling in when they needed some brews done, and so I saw everything they had built there for a tap room, and they'd stopped.
Yeah.
And it's the infrastructure here, but also the same point, that part of the Chinatown area is a little rough.
Yeah.
It needs some help. It definitely needs some help and some love.
So two things that are often associated with breweries are events and food.
Mm-hmm.
Which of those do you think is more important for a brewery?
Food.
Yep. But the food comes with complications, right?
Absolutely.
So how do you think about food or food trucks or like making those kinds of decisions?
So I think with the food truck thing, it's a chicken and the egg situation.
Yeah.
And every chicken and egg situation works better when there's more chickens and more eggs. Then you're like, oh, whatever. We've got plenty of chickens, plenty of eggs, and so it all works. So if you're a brewery and you're doing really well, you can have food trucks. Then you have your food problem solved, and you don't have to deal with the headache.
Yeah.
But if you're a brewery that's, we do fine. But food would definitely make it better.
When I go to South of Shaw, I sit there for a while because I order pizzas.
Absolutely.
And I just work through it that way. Whereas a food truck might go out there, but it's different.
Also, food truck isn't necessarily like reasonably priced either.
No.
You'd think, and then you go out and you're like, oh, it's a sushi food truck. And then you're like, $22 for a roll.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm going to just have the two beers, and then I'm going to go home and I'm going to make myself a sandwich.
Yeah. I had that experience recently at a brewery where I think I spent almost $60 on some barbecue, and I'm not going to name any names, but I was sad when I got it, and I was like, shit, I should have just driven down the road and got something and then come back. It's the challenge, right?
But I also know for a fact that there are breweries, including Summer Fox, that we wouldn't be here if we didn't have a kitchen.
Yeah.
It got us through COVID.
Yeah.
That was kind of a big thing. Mm-hmm. It bumps our ticket prices. It keeps people here longer. It makes people want to drink more, right? And in a responsible way that you want, right? But it is a headache. It is a thing. You have to work on kitchen staff. You have to work on what's on the menu and ingredient source. We buy from one of the largest suppliers of restaurants, and we get an order. Hey, where's the cheese? Oh, we're out of cheese this week. You're like, how are you out of cheese? You're the cheese supplier. I buy cheese. Everybody buys cheese from me. How are you out of cheese? Like, we're out of cheese. We'll get more next week. And you're like, okay, now I don't have cheese for my pizza. Then you have to go down to the grocery store and buy cheese, which, by the way, these guys probably sold them. So you're like, okay, cool. Now I'm just paying a markup for something that I could have gotten anyways. But
food makes sense to me because if I'm sitting there drinking and I'm getting a little hazy and I'm like, I can order a pizza and then it's a sponge. That's great. What's the ROI on events? Do you think they actually bring in the value that breweries, because a lot of breweries put on events.
Yeah. Events are very important. For two reasons. One, obviously that day in particular, you're going to have more people through the door, so it's going to be a good day. But the second reason is events draw people in who aren't necessarily beer people.
Yeah.
So we're doing trivia. We have a lot of people who come in and they just get sodas and they got a pizza and they don't really drink.
Yeah.
we're happy. They're our customers. They're buying stuff from us.
Yeah.
And that's great. And they're interacting with people who are drinking, and it's a great environment. So, but if you don't have food, then what's the draw? So it's one of those, again, which one do you pick first?
It's a collective action problem. Where you need all these things to, it's a confluence of things.
And so I would say food is going to, in the long run, do better things for you and allow you to do more events that are more successful because you have the food.
Okay. Do you think there's a type of brewery Fresno's missing? Because there's an array
of
types.
There's absolutely types of breweries that we're missing, but I don't think we're big enough yet to warrant those breweries.
What kinds?
So these are like super niche breweries.
Yeah.
So breweries that are like, oh, yeah, we're a Belgian beer producer.
Yeah.
We only make Belgian beers. Yeah. But guess what? You know how many cities have just a Belgian brewery in them? Like 3. So it's like Denver, Portland, and San Diego. And I don't even think San Diego has one anymore because everybody diversifies. So those super niche ones. And the easiest one would be like a lager house. So you go to Denver and there's 3 of them. You go to Portland, there's a couple. San Diego has got some breweries that are known for lager production, but they still make hazy IPAs and stuff like that because they understand diversifying is going to keep more people happy. But I would say, those niche places, you miss an experience of going to we are a Reinheitsgebot brewery. There's not a lot of them in the United States.
Yeah.
Right? But there are some. And we used to have Gordon Biersch, and unfortunately they closed down, but that's its unique experience, and Fresno's not big enough for it. The beer scene isn't big enough for it, but at the same time, there's not a whole ton that are big enough for it. There's also not any really hardcore themed breweries that are just like, we are a D&D nerdy, we drink mead from horns, or we are a black metal brewery, and you walk in, all everything's painted black, and they're like, have this IPA, and you're like, we don't like you, and then you could be rude even though they're probably Cicerone and their beer is amazing. There's breweries like that in Denver that I've been to. They're just a cool experience because they take a different attitude towards customer service and towards their product. We don't have that. We're definitely a little bit more vanilla on the breweries. I think we've got some that we do things really well and we lean into that. So you look at my Machine Head.
Yeah.
Hazy IPAs and his sours. Fantastic. Everybody knows that.
Yep.
And
I've had them. I love them.
Right? Go talk to Rob and be like, hey, Rob, you going to brew a blonde ale? He's like, I'm not going to brew a blonde ale. And I'm like, Rob, you should brew a blonde ale. I don't need a brew. I'm fine. I'm like, all right, cool, bro. Like, I love Rob. But at the same time, I'm like, come on, blonde ale. Like, we have a tap room literally like a mile and a half, 2 miles, maybe 3 miles away. Within an easy, people can bicycle between our breweries.
Yeah.
And they do.
Yeah.
Our number one beer is a blonde ale.
Yeah.
So I'm like, but that's his thing, and that's his niche, and it is working. So we're getting that way. But somebody at some point is going to open up like a punk rock bar that just serves IPAs, or a brewery that just serves IPAs, and we'll see what happens.
I would love – so I lived in Pasadena for a couple years, and there was like a brew pub, English style, called Lucky Baldwin's. And they had a beer list that was unparalleled. I think it was 3 pages long. Probably had 250 beers in there.
Yep.
It's incredible. Is there anything like that here?
I mean, the closest thing you can get is Goldstein's.
Yeah.
They do have actually a bottle and can list that's actually pretty good.
Yeah.
And they've got like 50 taps.
Yeah. We need more of those. I think those are great ways to find things, right?
Yes. So there's definitely tons of those places in San Diego that I used to frequent. And their specialty and why they're successful is because it's not just San Diego beer. It's, we get all this kind of interesting, cool bottles from Oregon and from Colorado and from back east and Michigan. And so but I'll tell you this, being the beer purchaser for a place like that is nuts.
Sure. Yeah, I'm sure.
Because a lot of it is, and maybe this goes back to the earlier question about what can our elected officials do to help the beer industry.
Yeah.
It's not just like taxes, but remove some regulation. Like the fact that I can't order say I'm a brew pub, I want to order a case of New Holland beer.
Yeah.
Okay, how do you get that? But you got to hope New Holland distributes here. Otherwise, you can't get it at all. Mm-hmm. They do. Okay, cool. So who's their distributor? Actually, they don't have a distributor in Fresno. So you have to talk to a distributor that is distributed out of LA and then be like, hey, I'll come down and pick it up. So there's all of these, like, mailing and all that. Like, you can't ship beer interstate. Huh. But you can for certain states because they allow it. But so all of the regulations in every state are just completely different.
So we just need something, like, clear and coherent that makes sense.
Kind of a universal rule.
Yeah.
So, like, in California, for the longest time, you couldn't fill a growler that wasn't your growler from the brewery.
Interesting.
It had to have your brand and all of your information on it. And then they made some rules like, well, if you like tape over the old one and put a sticker on it, you can have it. And then during COVID, they're like, you know, do whatever the fuck you want. We don't want to come and touch you.
Yeah.
And then guess what? Nothing bad happened. So basically, they don't enforce those rules anymore because nothing bad happened. Because me filling a Firestone Walker growler, because that's the growler that the guy has, and then putting a little tag that says Summer Fox Hazy IPA on it, nothing bad happened.
That's the problem. With,
and
just,
so,
just layers of bureaucracy.
I think I counted at one point. My little brewery made 600 kegs a year. We did like $300,000 in sale. I think I had a report to 17 different government agencies, half of which were literally, I'm just here.
Yeah.
Literally just you have to register with the FDA. Why do I have to register with the FDA? It's the Food and Drug Administration. But I'm registered with the TTB, who's also part of the – why am I registering with two? It's because this law said that you had to, and this law said you had to go over here. And then – but the people who regulate you are actually this part of the TTB, which is the same people – it's the ATF. And so the person coming out is also inspecting the gun place next door. Yeah, how do they possibly fucking know what's going on? I had a friend, he had an inspection from the federal government, and they showed up, and they were like all worried and concerned. And they're like, oh, we made sure everything was organized and clean and all of our numbers and everything. The guy walks in, he's like, yep, you're a brewery. Can I get a growler of IPA to go? And you're like, what? Why don't, what? Like,
these are the people in charge.
Yeah. And the thing is, that's exactly how it should be. I have a license to be a brewery. Cool. This isn't a mafia front.
Yeah, just let
awesome.
Me operate.
Yeah, and so the guy, I think, did exactly what I would want. I would do in the same situation. So, look, I'm just here to make sure that the map, the thing that you showed me, that has the certain size tanks and all that, is accurate. So you're not some like Anheuser-Busch pretending to be a small brewery and then lying about how much you're selling, and so you're skipping out on taxes, which is that's all they're there for.
Let's imagine you're at a beer conference, a brewer's conference of some kind, and someone comes up to you from some kind of mid-level city and says, "Describe the Fresno beer scene to me." How would you describe the Fresno beer scene?
Juvenile?
Okay.
Growing. It's
okay.
Not there yet.
Okay.
Because we've got some good beer.
What do we need to do? What do we need to do?
Just keep doing what we're doing. Because it's just about exposure. I think the thing that you talk to anybody in town right now, and you're like, what would be, if you could magically have one thing happen, what would it be? And I think most everybody in town is like, well, I wish I could just have more people walk through my door.
Yeah.
Because I know I've got a good product. I know I've got good staff. If I just had some more people walk through my door, I could convince them to be my customer.
Yeah.
And marketing is always the most difficult thing. There's, I don't know how true it is, but I hear this, is that for every pint of Budweiser, half of it is spent in ingredients, the other half spent in marketing.
Sounds right.
Which does sound right.
Yeah.
They're everywhere, and they hear about them all the time. And so if it's, okay, if I have to spend, it cost me 50 cents to brew a pint, I got to spend 50 cents per pint to sell that pint.
So do we need more brand recognition in Fresno?
I think just people knowing that there even are breweries. We've got people who live like less than a mile away from here who come in every week.
Really? Like first time?
Yeah, first time. Oh, I didn't know there's a brewery here. It's, we're 5 years old. We've been here for 5 years. And they're like, oh, I had no idea. I've lived down the street for 20 years. And then I talk to people who are like, oh, no, I know you're there. I'm like, oh, thanks. I have no interest. But so awareness is such a huge issue. And that's something that, as the president of Central Valley Brewers Guild, it is our main focus, is to make sure that people know that there's these local businesses. A lot of these guys who started these breweries, local home brewers jumping up to the pro level, they make really good beer.
Yeah.
And we're invested in our community. We would love to hire as many people as we possibly could from around here so that we don't have to do 45 different jobs.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
How many hats do you wear as a small business owner? You wear all the hats.
Yeah.
And you get a little bit bigger, and then you can take a hat off and hand it to somebody else. And gosh, I'd love to hand every hat except for one off to everybody else.
Do we have enough brewing talent in terms of employees for you, like in the area, or do we need to cultivate that?
That is definitely something that we need to work on. There's this small, awesome homebrew community here. Yeah. It's a little bit older, and I think a lot of the guys have either gone pro or have decided to keep it a hobby. I think
Has Ben Como's kind of served like a function in that world in terms of...
Absolutely. It closing is a disappointment. There's not a hub anymore, but he's the owner, Julian Ben Como, right? He named after himself. And his brother run it, and they're still doing like an online thing, so they'll still do deliveries and stuff like that. So he's going to keep it going in that regard. But having a brick and mortar just doesn't make sense anymore. Which is unfortunate because it is a cultural center for that community. So maybe we're definitely, me and some of our owners here, are definitely a little bit more connected to the homebrewers than I think some other ones.
What's the ambition for the guild? What would you hope to get out of it?
So, I mean, my biggest hope is that it means that all of our members, get more recognition. They get that people know, there's a very cool, vibrant craft beer scene. Like, I hear more about Bakersfield's craft beer scene than ours. And I've been down there. I've had some of the beers down there.
That's interesting, because I think Fresno's is so much better.
Yeah, no.
No shade, but...
No, I think it's... I agree. I think the quality's great here. I know when I talk to other people, they're like, oh, yeah, we're driving up to Sacramento's. Yeah, I'm going to stop by. I'm stopping Bakersfield and go to... Like, name off a couple.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, hey, Fresno? They're like... Oh, there's Tioga Sequoia. I'm like, no, dude, there's 20 breweries in the Fresno area now. Yeah. You got to go check it out. It's like, when did that happen? It's like literally in the last 5 years. Okay.
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot until like right before COVID. So it's getting there. And that's why I say it's we're maybe at our adolescent juvenile stage. We're growing. I think just adding more and more breweries isn't necessarily the answer. I think we need to build our customer base. We need to build our customer education that they know what good beer is, that they know that the diversity of beer, it's not just IPAs and lagers.
Yeah.
There's this whole middle ground and this darker side and this sour side and this all these cool things. And so that's the guild's goal, is to through events, through marketing, through all sorts of different channels, through just sharing the news from one brewery to another, saying, yeah, no, we know all each other. We got a meeting next week, like literally. And we're in it to see all of our boats rise up in a tide, but the tide is what has to go up. And so that's what we're trying to build right now, is we're trying to get more demand for our breweries. And I think the demand is there as long as people know about it.
Yeah. And I love that, because something I've encountered a lot here, and I'm sure you have as a transplant as well, is there can be this kind of zero sum or scarcity mentality. If someone is successful, is there enough room? Is the market big enough to hold everybody? Mm-hmm. And I think it is. I 100% think it is. And that for me has been one of my kind of like rallying cries, is we need a lot more of all the things, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It shouldn't be just one or two breweries like managing the space. We need a fleet of them, because we all have different tastes and preferences, right?
And that's true. What I'm saying, specialization, like I was saying earlier, like there's going to be breweries, once you get big enough, they're like, no, we just do lagers. We just do hazy IPAs. I mean, like a Humble C here might be a little difficult, because it's all hazy IPAs, a couple pastry stouts, and I think when I was there last, they had a Kolsch on. And so I drank the Kolsch and a couple tasters of it, because that's what I drink. But like that type of brewery here may struggle.
Yeah.
Simply because it's very niche.
Yeah.
But you talk to anybody who knows anything about craft beer, and you're like, Humble C. Oh, yeah, they're a really good brewery.
Yeah.
It's, I don't know, maybe you look at a Venn diagram, and there's the number of people who want to drink craft beer and the number of people who know that they want to drink craft beer. And how much does that overlap? You go in San Diego, and there's a ton of overlap. And then you go to other places, and you're like, I think there's just as many people who like Portland's like 50% market share on craft beer of the beer that's sold in Portland is 50% of its craft beer.
That's incredible.
And in San Diego and Denver, they're in like the 40-up percents. Nationally, it's 15 to 18%. Yeah. Here, I would imagine it's around the national average, if not a little less. So it's like our demographics aren't that much different. People generally like the same things regardless of certain demographics. People like things in their own way. And so even if we doubled that, we'd still be far behind Portland and Denver.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden there'd be twice as many drinkers, and then you're like, oh, there's twice as many drinkers. So a couple more breweries, absolutely fit. The breweries that are here are going to be profitable and sustainable, and they're going to last a long time and do great things.
Okay, a couple Summer Fox questions to close up. If you're a beer nerd, what beer should we order on your menu?
Right now, we've got, if you came in the next week, we've got a bunch of barrel-aged beer on right now.
Okay.
So we don't do it very often. We're sitting right next to our barrels here. We usually, like once a year, we'll pop a barrel-aged beer. And so for our anniversary in December, we usually put a couple of those on.
Mm.
So we've got a 5th anniversary barrel-aged blend with our Imperial Milk Stout and our stock Old Ale, which I called Old Fresno 1872, which is in these barrels right here. I pulled one of these barrels off a month ago and blended it up, and I think it's delicious. So that's definitely a nerdy thing. But at the same time, I think we do a really good job with hazy IPAs. I think right now we only have our Joytone, which is our core, but it's won awards at the state level here, the state fair and all that.
I love some Llamas, too.
So Llamas in the Fog, that's a funny one. It was our first award that we won here when I started working here.
It sold a number of my friends on you guys. They had Llamas, and they just every time they came back to Fresno, I'm like, can we do that. Back and get some Llamas?
Actually, I think we do that pretty much every spring now. It's kind of a seasonal for us.
Yeah.
It's really funny. So like we'll brew a whole batch of it, and we'll blow through the first half of it in a month.
Yeah.
And then the last half of it, everybody's like, oh, I got my fill. Because it's a milkshake IPA.
Yeah, I mean,
so
it's
one of those
heavy.
Ones.
It's heavy.
Exactly. It's not like an everyday drinker, but it's a special fun beer that's like when it comes out, it's cool. So I'm really excited about Tower. Because it's going to be...
Yeah, that was my next question, so talk about it.
So Tower is going to be our third location. We're hopefully a couple months out. We've been saying that for 6 months, that we're a couple months out.
And specifically, where are you at in Tower?
Right, so it's in the Venice Village. So it's on Venice, right next to the...
Is that the old Full Circle space?
It's the old... yes. So it was called Club Fred, and then it was Audi's Olympic, and then it was Full Circle Olympic, and then COVID killed it for Full Circle because they opened it like 6 months before it, then they probably did the right thing and saw that, and like, all right, this isn't going to, and they pulled out. It had been available since then, actually. And then we ended up meeting the new owners of the property, and we
The fire didn't affect any of that because there was a fire at Spokeasy there.
So Spoke's like three buildings down.
Okay.
And it was like, I can't remember if it was somebody was making a fire for themselves to keep
warm or something going on in the alley.
It was a little sketchy. Yeah, that was a real bummer because we were really looking forward to having some synergy there with the two spots to drink. People can walk back and forth. We'll have food. They usually get some food trucks out front, so you can make it a little scene there. That's a little more casual than like Olive, where it can get a little clubby.
Yeah.
But we're really excited about that because now for beers like Llamas, now we've got literally 50% more velocity on those beers. Yeah. So it's going to mean that we can brew it more frequently. It'll be fresher more often. And we can definitely do the thing we talked about earlier of what do you want? The same beer all the time or something new all the time? And so we can do both now.
This summer, when are we thinking?
We have posted our alcohol license, which is a 45-day thing. So it's like a 30-day posting, which we posted right after Christmas. End of the month, that'll be up. And then it's usually 2 or 3 weeks after that until the license appears.
Okay.
Awesome. But then we need to get our occupancy from the city.
Okay.
And so right now we're going through health department reviews on the kitchen. So that because the part of our business plan is we have wine and cider and seltzer and stuff like that, which you have to have a kitchen for if you're a brewery. So you go to other breweries and you're like, oh, you guys don't have wine. They can sell their own beer, but they can't sell anything else.
We
can buy other people's beer. We can sell wine because we have the kitchen. So that's an integral part of the business model.
Yeah.
So we have to go through those processes right now. And unfortunately, we had submitted a lot of that stuff like months and months ago. And then it goes to somebody's desk and then it sits there for 2 weeks. And then they get it and they go, oh, this needs to be 42 inches instead of 39 inches. And instead of being like, hey, you're approved tentatively. You just have to fix this. And if I see it, then it'll go right there. It then goes to us and then it goes back to the bottom of the pile and then you wait 2 weeks until it gets to the top of their pile again and they go, oh cool, you fixed it, all right, now I will send it off to, oh wait, nope, you didn't fix it over here. And it's,
you can
like
tell that Alex and I love bureaucracy so much.
And I don't that's what they're told
it's their job, right?
Yes. At the end of the day, like I can't be mad at the person, but I can absolutely be frustrated with the process.
Yeah.
And so that's where we've sat for the last, like, we're in a situation where we need to open 2 weeks. We can open in 2 weeks.
Right? Yeah.
But we're looking hopefully March, but
hopefully by Porchfest, because that would be incredible.
Oh my God. We are one of our longtime employees. He plays like in six bands that play Porchfest, and he's in tune with all that stuff. And he's going to be a big part of Tower for us and in our company. And so we just keep on Porchfest. All right, what's going on? All right, we're so excited. We want to be the hub of Porchfest there. We're come in and get a map. We've got them. Hey, here's all the places, go around. And then like day after, we're the after party or whatever. Like, we really want to integrate ourselves with all those really awesome things that happen in Tower. Cause we talk about what's more important, food or events. So we've got the food. So now we got to focus on events
and
being event focused and in that community, is, I think, going to be great for everybody involved. Cause now there's a breakfast spot and a coffee shop on that street, but there's no other. And then there's the Chinese food place right next door to us.
Yeah.
But otherwise, there's no other food over that time. And so there's a little bit of a void there. And even entertainment-wise, there's been a void since Full Circle left. We're really excited to fill that.
It's going to be great. We close these podcasts in the same place, always, with book recommendations. This can be beer-related or anything. What's a book or two you'd recommend?
So let's start with beer, because there's a beer called Tasting Beer. And I don't know who wrote it, but I've read it. A long time ago, and I always recommend it to anybody who works for me or wants to learn about beer. Go on Amazon, just Tasting Beer. I think it's on like the third edition.
Okay.
It goes through the history. It goes through the process in a way that is very approachable.
Is it similar to those wine Bibles that you can look through and they'll chart the different places and like
having never read a wine Bible, I wouldn't know, but yeah, sure.
I don't even know if that's what they're called.
It goes through like the history of beer. It goes through the process of making beer. It goes through like some modern inventions. It goes through styles, and it's just, it gives you an all-around picture of beer and the beer industry and what it means to civilization, because I mean, we built the pyramids with beer and bread, so
yeah, we did.
We can do a lot of cool things with beer and bread.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Did you have a non-beer related recommendation?
Oh, I love Star Wars, so I just read all the Star Wars books.
Okay. You're into sci-fi?
My brewery that I started was called Intergalactic Brewing Company.
Okay.
So that was my nerd world.
Okay. If no one's ever read a sci-fi novelistic, I don't even know what to call it, where should they start? Let's just imagine they've seen all the movies.
Yeah, like, if you've seen all the Star Wars movies, let's go with Star Wars, because you go into Star Trek and there's novels and stuff like that.
Yeah,
a lot of it gets really into the lore and everything. But one of the there's a lot of controversy about Disney owning Star Wars now, but one thing they did do was they reset the universe.
Yeah.
So there's not as much content that's crazy. So there's a couple of novels that happen right after Episode 6 that kind of lead into everything that happens, and they're called like the Aftermath series.
Yeah.
And it's a good series. It's pretty easy to read, and it goes way more into the lore of what happens in the universe before the new movies with Kylo Ren and Rey and all that stuff.
What's your favorite Disney TV show, Star Wars based? For me, it's Andor. It's Andor. Yeah. Like the first season of Mandalorian was great, but Andor, it gave me it scratched an itch that I didn't realize I had.
I think Andor did something that Star Wars didn't know they could do, where it was definitely...
it's like prestige TV is what
it felt. It was a little bit highbrow, and it was intentional, and it was in the Star Wars universe, but it didn't overtly be like, we're in the Star Wars universe. No, it was just a story about a fledgling rebellion that just happened to be in the Star, and they're like, oh, it's Star Wars. This is awesome. Yeah. Whereas you go into Acolyte and stuff like that, and it's, we have to go with laser swords everywhere. And it's okay, it was a story about the Jedi and all that. Yeah. And so I think that was the refreshing thing about Andor, was like, I feel like this story could work in any universe. It just so happens to be in the Star Wars universe.
Yeah. Are you playing the video game?
Which one?
The newest, the RPG.
The Outlaws? I haven't, no.
I haven't either. I'm intrigued by it.
I keep seeing people saying, this game's actually really good. Yeah. No, but I would say, honestly, Mando Season 1, I do really find Andor really good. Because
it was a
really
reset,
good.
You know?
Exactly. Yeah. And it was like, let's see what happens. That said, for live action, I'd say that one, but Clone Wars is...
That's true fans, that's what they say.
And especially because I know Disney canceled the rest of Season 7, and then they finally were able to go back and do it. Yeah. And the Disney produced last season of Clone Wars is like, it's literally its own little trilogy in it, and it's absolutely awesome. So,
and if you're turned off by the animated element, you just get past yourself. You know, that's the
honestly. I actually think Star Wars is better animated.
Yeah,
I think if they did a new Jedi series with like where they do Luke and all of his like before Kylo Ren or Ben Solo does his does this whole thing and destroys it. Like, that whole thing, I think, as a cartoon, would actually be really good.
I was so disappointed by the Obi-Wan series. I don't know why it didn't hit me, but it just wasn't good enough.
I think it was all just building up to the fight, and the fight was good.
Yeah.
In that moment, and the reason he was doing it. But there was a lot of stuff that, it was slow, like Andor.
Yeah.
But it wasn't as, I don't know, it wasn't as world building as Andor.
Yeah.
Right?
It didn't feel deliberate. It didn't feel like, it felt like just like table setting for a bunch of episodes.
They're like,
I'm just like, what are we doing?
We want to have this awesome duel with Obi-Wan and Vader. And I think everybody wanted to see that. That's exactly what everybody wanted to see. We want to see Darth Vader be badass. And he was.
Yeah.
But then the first couple episodes were like, okay, this is really like one episode worth of content.
Yeah.
And so if they made that like a shorter series... Yeah. And just had he has to save Leia, and he saves Leia, and then he meets Vader, and they have a little fight, and then he goes away. But that may have been more successful.
I'm having really high standards for prestige TV that I actually sit down and watch. It's got to be good. I just watched the Penguin series, and that blew my mind.
Yeah.
And that, it was so great that it came around when it did, because I was feeling like I was watching a bunch of mid content. I didn't want to do that, and I watched that series, and so. I'd recommend that.
Yeah, I'm just a homer. I'm just like, it's Star Wars. I'll enjoy it. But I do enjoy the nicer ones more.
Yeah, absolutely. Alex, this has been a lot of fun. Please come to his brewery. So this one's on North Santa Fe. So it's like Herndon and 99.
Yeah, so Herndon, Melbourne.
And then Clovis is literally on Clovis Avenue, just like south of Shaw, right?
Yep. So at Gettysburg, we're right south of Costco.
Awesome. This has been so much fun.
Yeah,
thanks for doing it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/FresnosBest. We'll see you next time.